This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What were the motivations of the men responsible for September 11th? Journalist Terry McDermott has traveled around the world and spent years doing research trying to answer that question. His new book, Perfect Soldiers, tries to explain how men who were mostly from apolitical and unexceptional backgrounds became extremists. McDermott is a national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. One of the 9/11 hijackers McDermott profiles is Muhammad Atta, who is believed to have piloted American Airlines Flight 11 from Boston, which attacked the North Tower of the World Trade Center. Atta grew up in Egypt and went to Germany to attend college. I asked McDermott how Atta was radicalized in Germany.
First of all, he was a more active participant in the religion than he'd ever been in Cairo. His family in Cairo didn't even go to mosque. His mother didn't wear a scarf or a veil. In Germany, he began to associate with people at one particular mosque that had a very radical interpretation of Islam. This mosque called El Quds, the preachers frequently called upon the congregation to drop their lives and join the jihad. And this was not a metaphorical exhortation. They were asking them to go and fight. And Atta became more and more enamored of this idea. And he and a small group of friends spent enormous amounts of time talking about where they should fight, what it meant to fight, what their obligation was. Literally years they spent talking about these things. And so the process, these guys, I thought, I would try to find the person who recruited them into the cause. But they weren't recruits, really. They were volunteers. I mean, they recruited themselves.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is the person who proposed the idea to bin Laden back in 1996 of flying a plane into a building. Can you talk a little bit about what that original proposal was like and how Mohammed became the person to talk to bin Laden about it?
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is an ethnic Pakistani who grew up in Kuwait and went to the university in North Carolina. And when he returned from there, he went to Afghanistan to fight in the war against the Soviet Union, which ended soon after he got there. Not long after that, he and a nephew became involved in a series of plots, almost none of which were executed, but all of which aimed at Americans and/or American allies. The plane for the ideas came about when they were in Manila in late 94 and early 95. They developed an idea to hijack commercial airplanes over the Pacific Ocean and blow them up with everybody aboard dying. The plan was to have five or six people hijacked a couple of different planes, and they would plant bombs on board, and then at intervening stops would get off, and the planes would fly over the ocean and crash. That was interrupted by Philippine police, and the co-conspirators were all caught, but Mohammed never was. And he kept the idea, and it went through various iterations. By the time he brought it to Al-Qaeda in 1996, the idea had changed from simple hijackings to taking the planes over, piloting them as missiles. He proposed doing this to bin Laden, who wasn't quite so sure it was a workable idea initially.
What was bin Laden's objection?
It's too complicated and too hard to do. He wasn't so sure that the bombers could plant bombs and then get away. Of course, the great innovation of modern terror is finding people willing to not get away, finding people willing to commit suicide in the participation in these plots. So the plan morphed into this idea of hijacking planes, putting their own pilots aboard them, and then using them as targeting them toward their destinations.
So did Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and bin Laden decide together that the thing to do would be to recruit suicide bombers to fly the planes into buildings?
They did. In fact, bin Laden had pilots in mind, or people who would be pilots in mind already, and he nominated four men to lead the mission, two Saudis and two Yemenis. At that point, the idea was that two of the flights would be flights from Asia and two of the flights would be flights within the United States. So the two Saudis went to California, and the two Yemenis went to Malaysia. They were never able to bring that plot about. I mean, they had visa problems. It quickly became apparent that the Yemenis were bad to having these plots because it was hard for them to get visas to go anywhere. So the plot changed again, and they looked further for pilots who could get into the United States and train. And that's when they found Muhammad Atta and his friends.
How did they find Atta?
Atta delivered himself. He and his friends from Hamburg in late 99 decided, as I said earlier, to go to Chechnya, and they were told the best way to get to Chechnya to fight the war against the Russians was to go through the training camps in Al-Qaeda. And they were told how to do this through Pakistan, and they went. And they arrived in Kandahar and were immediately seized upon by bin Laden as recruits for the planes operation, as 9/11 was called, within Al-Qaeda. I think the thing that excited them about these men's potential for this plot was, one, they were somewhat technically proficient. Otto was a degreed architect and urban planner. And also, being an Egyptian, it was easy to get a passport visa to the United States. He also spoke fluent English and German. Most of the people in the Al-Qaeda camps didn't speak any other language other than Arabic. And most of them came from places that it was harder to get visas to America from. So I think Atta was from Egypt. Another fellow, Marwan al-Shehi, was from the United Arab Emirates. A third pilot was from Lebanon. And the fourth would-be pilot was from Yemen. As with the earlier men from Yemen who tried to engage in the plot, the man from Yemen never got a visa, so he was never part of it. The other three got into the United States and went to flight school. They eventually found a fourth pilot. Again, he just walked into the camps one day. A Saudi who was already a licensed commercial pilot.
Did you get any sense of whether Atta or any of the other pilots at any point during the planning period had any second thoughts about dying for this mission?
Yeah, I think some of them did. I think Atta himself, before he left for the camps in 99, two things happened. One, in the autumn of that year, he asked for a private meeting with a friend of his, a German friend, a Muslim convert in Hamburg, a younger man who Atta had mentored somewhat. And he warned the man to beware of radical interpretations of Islam, that the man should live a holy life and follow the Quran, but be wary of anyone who tried to enlist him in other causes. And within weeks after that meeting, Atta, having just received his graduate degree, went home to visit his family. And his mother was ill at the time. She had developed diabetes. And he asked, before it was time to return to Germany, he asked her if he could stay in Egypt and take care of her, to forego further studies. And she said, no, your father, who wants you to earn a doctorate, is right. You should go to America and get a PhD. So it indicated some willingness to be talked out of this.
One of the people you spoke to was Muhammad Atta's former landlord. And she told you that she felt endangered just being around him. He'd look at her wearing a sleeveless shirt and you know, just be incredibly angry over that. Was she afraid to talk with you? Did she think that if she talked to you, somebody else who was a militant Muslim would get back at her?
I think she was more afraid of the media. There are so few people who knew these guys.
No, afraid to talk to you. I mean, you are the media.
Right, but I protected her identity. But she was afraid of talking to anybody for fear that her name would be revealed.
Right.
The two roommates, two men who lived with Muhammad Atta over a period of 5 years, one for 3 years, one for 2 years, have never been interviewed by anybody except me. And it was, you know, you're sitting there in Hamburg, you know, beating your head trying to figure out who can we talk to, who can we find, who actually knew them. And the people who had talked prior, you know, like, knew him for a week or a month or 2 months. And you're thinking, the guy lived here for 7 years, you know. He had, who did he live with? But you couldn't even get the names of the guys. German privacy laws are very harsh, and you can't get anything. Reverse telephone directories are against the law. I mean, that's how hard it is. A criminal's name can't be published in a newspaper because the name belongs to the criminal. So just finding these guys was just extraordinarily difficult. And they didn't want to be found because they were afraid of just becoming besieged by the media hordes. Finding them was just, in some ways, a stroke of luck. We knew where the house was, where they had lived, and we knew the house manager, and we'd talked to him more or less politely initially about trying to get the names, and it was against the law, so he wouldn't give them to us. And after a couple weeks of trying other ways and not getting anywhere, myself and my Arabic translator, my German translator, dressed black from head to toe. I'm 6'1", 200 pounds, and these guys both are much bigger than me. Uh-huh. And we walked into this guy's office, and my German translator, Dirk, handed the guy, we'd rehearsed this ahead of time. I said, just give him my card. Tell him we want the information. We know he has it. If he gives it to us, we'll go away. And this is just pure stupidity. We walk in. Dirk hands him the card, says, we know you have the information. We came to get it. The guy reaches in his desk drawer, pulls out a file, and says, is this what you need?
I thought you could say he pulls out a gun.
No, he pulled in. Here's a file with the guy's names and phone numbers, where they lived, and we tracked them down, and they agreed to talk.
What they tell you?
Well, that's where I think this the basis of the image of Muhammad Atta that is in the book comes from these people who lived with him and knew him fairly intimately, and that is this sort of aggressive insularity. They hated him. I mean, and one of these guys was like the most laid-back kind of college guy you could ever meet. You know, he just likes to go out and have a beer, and he's got a ton of friends, and he laughs.
These were his roommates when he was in college, not when he was,
right.
You know.
That's correct,
right.
Yes.
Okay.
In college in Germany.
In Germany. Mm-hmm.
Not in Cairo. When he was in college in Cairo, he lived at home. These were college in Hamburg roommates. And this guy lived with him for 2 or 3 years. And just grew to hate even seeing him. They shared a kitchen. Each had separate bedrooms, but they had common rooms or kitchens and bathrooms. And Muhammad would walk into the room when the guy was there with his girlfriend and not acknowledge anybody else even being in the room. He never washed the dishes. You know, simple roommate stuff, right? He didn't wash the dishes. He hated to eat, but when he would cook, he would like boil a whole pot full of potatoes, mash them up, sprinkle them with cumin, then eat them right out of the pot. And when he was done with that meal, he'd just stick the pot, the whole thing, in the refrigerator. And the next time mealtime came around, he'd walk to the refrigerator, pull out the pot, and eat some more, and stick the fork back in it. It was just, on the most basic level, was a bad roommate.
Do you think information like that helps us understand how Muhammad Atta became a suicide pilot on September 11th?
I think what it helps us understand is, the classic phrase, the banality of evil. I mean, there's nothing particularly exceptional about these people. They did exceptionally bad things, but they're normal people, and they're as screwed up as everybody else. And they're not uniformly bad or uniformly good. Marwan al-Shehhi was everybody liked to be around him. He was constantly carried candy with him everywhere he went, a little bag of candy. He'd give candy to all of his friends. He'd sit at the table and sing jihad songs or sing songs about how happy it would be to become a martyr. Happy-go-lucky, I guess we wouldn't call that here. But among his group of friends, it was regarded as quite entertaining. I think the personal information tells you the degree to which they were more or less normal human beings, and the degree to which there are many more or less normal human beings who would do something similar. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has said that Al-Qaeda was oversubscribed for martyr operations, more martyrs than there were plots to put them in.
You know, in terms of whether any of the hijackers had any reservations of dying for the mission of September 11th, one of the hijackers was actually in love and had recently been married. Tell us about him and how you think that his marriage may have affected his decision to participate.
Yeah, the man you're talking about is Ziad Jarrah, who was a Lebanese young man from Lebanon, from Beirut, who had moved to Germany in 1996 for university and fell in love with a young Turkish-German Muslim woman. And they were they became romantically involved very quickly after they met in 1996 and remained that way until September 11th. In fact, the last thing Jarrah did before he got on the airplane that morning was to call her. She was in southern Germany, in Bochum, southern Germany, and he called and said, "I love you," three times and hung up the phone. I think, you know, because of this relationship, it's often been supposed that Jarrah was more torn about the decision than others, and or less certain about the decision, in that he had something else to live for. And I'm not sure that's true. I mean, I think that misconstrues the nature of the beliefs these guys had. You know, committing suicide, martyrdom, to them was not at the cost of your life. It was the signifying act of their lives. It was something. He wrote her a letter that she got after the attacks, and in it he told her that she was proud of him. Not that he didn't apologize to her. He wanted her to know that he did it for them. It's an indication of the power of these beliefs, I think.
Did you meet any members of the hijackers' families who regretted the fact that their son or brother or cousin was part of September 11th?
You know, any horrific crime or big disaster, as reporters, you go out and you meet people. They talk to you largely because of remorse. They feel some small degree, maybe, but some degree of responsibility for the bad thing that happened. That if they had only done this or that, they could have prevented it. And in the course of interviewing probably 500 people for this book, I don't think I met five people who expressed that remorse. Many of the members of these men's families are still in denial about their participation in it. Those who are not in denial felt some, not responsibility, but just utter bewilderment about it. I must say, within the Arab world, which is sort of governed by myth in a lot of ways, it's almost pre-rational society, and myth plays a powerful role. And one of the overwhelming myths there is the omnipotence of the United States and of the CIA in particular and of the Israeli intelligence agency, the Mossad. If it was 10 people, it was 200 who told me that this could not have happened had it not been planned by the Mossad or the CIA. It's not a casually held belief. It's you see it in the front pages of newspapers. People still refuse to admit what actually happened, or not the events themselves happened, but who did it. And this includes the families of the hijackers.
Has writing this book about the September 11th hijackers affected your experience of flying and how you look at people who are on your plane or who are checking in?
Well, writing the book hasn't affected my experience of flying. The effects of 9/11 have greatly affected my experience of flying. It often now takes longer to get on a plane than it does to fly. I mean, it's made it harder to get on an airplane. I'm not sure it's made it harder for people to blow up airplanes. It has affected my view of strong beliefs. I'm not a religious person. I was raised in a religious household, but haven't ever practiced religion. And, you know, the thing I learned from the book most was how dangerous is the idea that you have the one true belief. And I think that the people who think they are in possession of the one true way for anything will do horrendous things to achieve it because they think everything is justified. I mean, I think religion is a great thing. It gives people comfort, many people great comfort. But it wrongly wielded, it's a horrible, sharp sword.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Terry McDermott is national correspondent for the LA Times. His new book is called Perfect Soldiers.